This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Race and Jews, Part 6. The Jews have infiltrated, manipulated, exploited, and outlived every nation, empire, and civilization in Europe and the Middle East for millennia. The Jewish problem is an old problem. And the racial character and nature of the Jews is not something Europeans only first noticed in the 15th century in Spain and reflected in their purity of blood statutes. It's a long-standing recognition of the Jews and their character. And it is about character. It's not restricted to physical, observable traits, superficial physical traits. It goes to the personality traits of the collective. Now, I've cited in the last couple of installments twittering, what people today are saying about the Jews, and especially about the Jews as a race. But I thought this time I'd talk a little bit about what significant figures in the past have had to say about the Jews as a race. And I'll start with Cicero. Cicero was a Roman statesman during the first century BC. And he said, "The Jews belong to a dark and repulsive force. One knows how numerous this clique is, how they stick together, and what power they exercise through their unions. They are a nation of rascals and deceivers." Tacitus, who was a senator and a historian with the Roman Empire during the 1st century AD, 100 years after Cicero, had more to say. In the Works of Tacitus, Volume 4, which was written by Thomas Gordon in 1752, I found a good summary. Gordon wrote about Tacitus, "Concerning the Jews, he followed the tradition and accounts current amongst the Romans. He tells you what different relations there were, and neither adds anything nor misrepresents things maliciously. It was an obscure state," now speaking of the Jews, "generally enslaved by some greater power to the Assyrians, Egyptians, Grecians, and then to the Romans, and condemned by all, as much as they themselves hated all. They had not common mercy or charity toward the Gentiles and uncircumcised, and being persuaded that the Almighty loved only themselves, they fancied that he abhorred, and therefore they abhorred, the whole human race besides. So that it was said by Tacitus too truly, 'Adversus omnes alios hostile odium.'" Now, this is a well-known phrase amongst literary scholars. Many other people have come up with variations on that theme, but what it means basically is they hate and are hostile to all others. That's a racial animus toward others. Now, I'll point out here that Gordon mentions the fact that even before the Romans, before Cicero had anything to say about it, before Tacitus had anything to say about it, the Jews already had established a long history of infiltrating, manipulating, exploiting, and outliving the Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, and many others less significant. Another reference to Tacitus comes from Notices of the Jews by the Classic Writers of Antiquity, by John Gill, and published in 1870. And he wrote that Tacitus had observed that the laws of the Jews were, quote, "hostile to men and calculated to inspire the Jew with hatred and opposition to the rest of mankind. This goes to the mechanism that I mentioned the last time of the Jewish narrative when they describe themselves as victims of oppression. Part of the effect that that has is on their host, in putting their host on the defensive and demoralizing their host. But part of it also gives morale to their own group, to their own people, and incites them to feel as a group and to act as a group. Now, another Greek giant in first century BC, so a contemporary of Cicero, named Strabo, had something to say about the Jews too, but I found a good reference to it that's embedded in what William Pierce had to say more recently about the Jews in a radio broadcast in 1998 titled How It Fits Together. I'm just going to read some excerpts here. Pierce said, "The world's 14 million Jews think and act like one big family, even though, like most families, they do a lot of arguing and squabbling among themselves. They go to different synagogues, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, or to no synagogue at all. There are atheist Jews, and there are Jews who have converted to Christianity. There are capitalist Jews and communist Jews, homosexual Jews and heterosexual Jews. There are rich Jews and middle-class Jews, and even a few poor Jews. But despite this apparent diversity, they do a better job of cooperating with each other and looking out for their common interests than other ethnic groups in the world. Why is this? Why are Jews more racially conscious than anyone else? Why are they so much more ready to collaborate with each other than members of other groups? Part of the reason is their religion. It is an ethnocentric religion, a racist religion. Whereas Christianity and Islam, for example, are universalist religions, religions for anyone who chooses to believe in them, Judaism is not. Judaism is a religion only for the chosen people, only for the circumcised sons of Abraham. Jews are defined in terms of their bloodline, not in terms of their faith, which is why non-religious Jews like Freud or Trotsky or even Marx, the father of atheist communism, are considered just as much Jews as the most pious synagogue goer with side locks and yarmulke. The non-religious Jews don't believe the hocus-pocus in their Torah or Old Testament, but they nevertheless are steeped in the folklore and traditions of Judaism. They are as familiar as their religious cousins are with the claims that Jews are a chosen people, destined to own all the world's wealth and to be waited on hand and foot by non-Jews. And they are familiar with the tales of persecution from the time of the pharaohs until the time of Hitler, with the tradition of being universally hated by all other peoples of the world, which is why they believe they are justified in avenging themselves on non-Jews wherever they have the opportunity." This is the mechanism that I'm talking about of the hatred and opposition to the rest of mankind that Tacitus mentioned, that by seeing themselves as victims of the rest of the world, they indirectly justify then exploiting and manipulating the rest of the world for their benefit. Pierce continues a little further on. I'm skipping over a bit here. "This tendency of the Jews to stick together, always to favor their fellow Jews over non-Jews, and to work for the interests of their tribe instead of just for their survival interests, is a fact, a very enviable fact. It is the primary reason for their extraordinary level of wealth and power through the ages. You know, there are clubby little groups of white men who cooperate with each other to advance their interests, but those interests are personal and individual, not racial or even tribal. And virtually all of the really influential groups of this sort, the Council on Foreign Relations, for example, or groups of very rich and powerful men, corporate bosses or bankers, are in fact heavily larded with Jews. They're not racial groups at all, even if they don't have any blacks or Chinamen in them. They're simply special interest groups, whereas the 14 million Jews of the world form a huge, self-conscious racial interest group. They really are unique in this regard. I wish that our people had the same degree of racial consciousness the Jews do. The Jews understand the power of togetherness. Most of our people don't. And this is largely the reason why we're in the mess we're in today." again, skipping ahead a little bit here. The second thing for us to understand about the Jews is their very unusual mode of existence, living nearly everywhere as a small minority among other peoples. If one looks at their history in the biblical period, they were at most times a people on the move, living as strangers and aliens among other peoples, getting kicked out of one place after another, always on terms of enmity with the Gentile host population. Only for a little over 400 years, from approximately the time of King David until the Babylonian conquest, did they really have a national existence in the ordinary sense of the word, with geographical borders. When the Babylonians dispersed the Jews throughout the Middle Eastern and Mediterranean world in the middle of the 6th century BC, the Jews adapted amazingly well to being a minority everywhere and a majority nowhere. 500 years later, in the 1st century BC, the Greek writer Strabo commented, quote, "The Jews have penetrated every country, so that it is difficult to find any place in the world where their tribe has not entered and become dominant," unquote. Note those words, "there is no place where they have not become dominant." The great geographer and historian Strabo, however you pronounce that, was not the only scholar of the ancient world to make that observation about Jews, about the Jews. The Jews became dominant by accumulating a substantial portion of the wealth of every country that they infiltrated, and they accumulated their wealth by collaborating with each other and preying on the host population. Their collaboration was based on their racial consciousness, on their conviction that they were a distinct and unique people, superior to the people among whom they lived, and deserving of whatever they could take away from their hosts. The Jews in Rome did not think of themselves as Romans who happened to believe in Judaism, but as Jews who happened to live in Rome. And the same for every other country where they lived. The same is true today. With the sort of attitude and behavior the Jews had, they were bound to be hated by everyone, and they reciprocated. The Jews regarded the hatred that they had for their hosts as justified, just as they considered deceiving and exploiting their hosts to be justified. But their hosts' hatred of the Jews they regarded as, quote, bigotry, unquote, and, quote, persecution, unquote. Poisecution. Their history is a chronicle of one poisecution after another, right down to modern times. During the Middle Ages, they were kicked en masse out of every country in Europe, repeatedly. They pretend today that this supposed poisecution was the result of religious bigotry on the part of their hosts, but in fact, it was simple self-defense on the part of their hosts, the same sort of reaction to their presence that the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans and everyone else in pre-Christian times had had. And it was this barrier of hatred between the Jews and the rest of the world which made it possible for them to maintain their identity and their sense of racial self-consciousness. Well, now for the remainder, I'll return to Eric Goldstein's book, The Price of Whiteness, that we've talked about several times earlier, picking up where we left off in chapter 4, What Are We? Jewishness Between Race and Religion. And this is right after the last part that I read from his book was about how in 1909 the Jewish leaders were testifying in front of Congress, and privately they were communicating to each other their fear that race scientists were close to declaring the Jews to be a non-white race and thus exclude them from America. And so they conspired to enlist the help of an anthropologist in order to get, quote, a very strongly worded declaration as to the practical identity of the white race, unquote. One that would presumably leave no doubt as to the whiteness of Jews. Now on page 110, skipping ahead a little bit from that part where we left off, during the first two decades, and this is getting into the details of how they did that, during the first two decades of the 20th century, Columbia University professor Franz Boas was the best-known anthropologist of Jewish origin in the United States. Boas shared the concern of the Jewish communal elite about racial nativism, but his preference to identify as a German-American rather than as a Jew prevented him from engaging too directly in Jewish defense efforts during these years. In other words, Boas was already committed to being a crypto-Jew. He wasn't openly a Jew and was instead presenting himself as a German-American. So he couldn't come forward as a Jew, or he couldn't even come forward as a German-American, because it would have been quickly exposed that he was, in fact, a Jew at the time. He was ambiguous, in the closet, you could say. Instead, Boas worked to discredit the centrality of race in evaluating human capabilities, arguing that differences between groups, including those between blacks and whites, were heavily influenced by environmental factors. That was part of his fraud, was to, as I've mentioned before, he produced skull measurement data that supposedly showed the plasticity of the human skull that even someone like Francis Parker Yockey bought into. This idea that by moving from one place to another, human beings would adapt to the soil in which they found themselves almost immediately in one generation, their skull shape would change. And if the skull shape could change, the implication was that just about anything having to do with race, any physical characteristic, was plastic in the same way. And the reality is that it wasn't true. Many people suspected at the time, but it wasn't discovered until decades later when other people crunched the numbers and found out that it was a fraud, that Boas had made fraudulent claims. Because these ideas contradicted the overwhelming consensus about the importance of racial difference in the United States, however, they offered little to Jewish leaders hoping to win acceptance for their group in white America. As a scholar who was well integrated into the non-Jewish world, Boas could freely advance such oppositional theories. In other words, because he was posing as a white German American, he had his advantage there in basically telling whites what to think about race in that respect. But for the Jews struggling to overcome their uncertain racial status, it was much harder to build their case for inclusion on ideas that undermined the basic assumptions of the larger society. To soothe white Americans' doubts about the, quote, Jewish race, unquote, they would have to affirm the basic distinction between black and white. The scientist who took up this challenge was Maurice Fishberg, one of the leading scholars of Jewish physical anthropology at the turn of the century, and the only American to devote himself significantly to such research. Well, it broke into two branches. Anthropology originally was all physical anthropology, and what Boas did was actually create cultural anthropology, which is the dominant form of anthropology today. Race science was being pursued under physical anthropology. Boas, the interesting thing to note about Boas is he didn't declare himself to be a fraud, of course, and he co-opted science. He assumed the mantle of science. He and his disciples presented themselves as objective scientists, informing the public about what science had to say about race. This was part of the fraud that they perpetrated. It was more than just skull measurements. It was other things that I went into in some detail in a series of podcasts earlier. He basically replaced, under the guise that he was doing science, he replaced the actual research and science with fraud and just-so stories about culture. Fishberg was a physical anthropologist, believed in race, and laid out his line of argument in a book titled The Jews, A Study of Race and Environment, which was published in 1911. But the Jews did not see Fishberg's story as good for the Jews, and they rejected it ultimately. On page 114 of Goldstein's book, he writes, "In denying any far-reaching racial distinctiveness and identifying Jews with other American whites, Fishberg had provided a scientific basis for the claims of Jewish leaders. Unlike other Jewish spokesmen, however, he pursued his conclusions with a rigid scientific consistency that was unable to make room for any lingering attachment to the notion of a Jewish race." Because he had made the argument for the temporary, artificial nature of Jewish difference so rigorously, he discounted not only the Jewish racial distinctiveness, but almost every form of Jewish particularity. By taking the denial of Jewish racial difference to its logical conclusion, Fishberg failed at satisfying the contradictory needs of American Jews, most of whom ultimately wanted to be accepted in white America without giving up their own distinctive racial identity. This failure was apparent in the almost universal condemnation the book received in Jewish circles. This was contradictory needs of American Jews that's being mentioned here is they wanted their cake and they wanted to eat it too. Basically, they wanted to be counted as a separate group, a racially distinct group, and they wanted to be considered part of the larger family of white races, in part in the larger white race. Fishberg argued in his book that Jews were not a, quote, race, creed, or nation, unquote, but simply a social phenomena. So that's how he decided to answer. While remaining true to race science to a certain extent, he distorted it by glossing over the difference of Jews. It's basically, he called Jews white, and said that there wasn't any significant racial difference between Jews and other whites. On page 115, we'll pick up again. Horace Wolf, a Reform rabbi in Chicago, scoffed at Fishberg's argument that the term, quote, Jewish race, unquote, was a scientific misnomer. Wolf said, "What do you care that our laboratory masters have dubbed us in error?" he asked. "So long as our lives reflect our implicit belief in the continued existence of the Jewish people." As I've pointed out many times before, they talk about, instead of race, they talk about Jewish peoplehood, and they talk about the Jewish people. It's really just a euphemism for race. And here, back in closer to the turn of the last century, is a rabbi doing exactly that, basically saying that it's the same thing, the Jewish people and race, same thing. If Jews found that race was an increasing liability and threatened to lump them with non-whites, they also found themselves unable to break the emotional commitment they had to a racial self-understanding. The result was a constant struggle with these two powerful impulses for their inclusion and distinctiveness, one that led many acculturated Jews to assert their status as a religious group in public while privately clinging to a much broader racial understanding of Jewishness. In 1910, addressing the question, "What are we?" for a Jewish audience, historian Max Margolis summed up the collective frustration of American Jews by concluding that the Jews were, quote, "a great anomaly which cannot be classified according to accepted rules of definition," unquote. In finding satisfactory terms for Jewish self-definition, complained another Jewish writer the same year, quote, "We succeed to about the same extent as the man who sets out to square the circle or to prove that twice two are five," unquote. This is smoke blowing, really, squid ink, that it's a big mystery. The Jews are unique. I said that in part one of this latest series here, and we make a mistake in trying to think of them and their thinking in terms that we understand and terms that make them somehow comparable to other races. And that's, I think, the main point, that when people say, "Oh, the Jews aren't a race," and I say they are racial, that the nature of their group is racial. That's what I'm getting at. I'm not trying to be two-faced or speak out of both sides of my mouth about it. I'm trying to describe it as best I can, how I understand what they really are. The nature of the connection that they have with each other is biological. It's heritable. It's racial. And yet they are not really a race that's comparable to, certainly not to, the continental races that most people think of today: black, white, yellow, and so forth. But in the time of the Greeks and the Romans, for instance, race had a finer grain meaning. It had more of a meaning that today nation or ethnicity, especially ethnicity, has, ethnic group, nation had a finer grained, or sorry, race had a finer grained meaning at the time. And in a sense, as I've argued before, nation and ethnic group are both also groups of a racial nature, connection by blood, by inheritance, biological. These two powerful impulses that are mentioned here, these two conflicting things, wanting, having their cake and wanting to eat it too, for inclusion and yet distinctiveness. They seem at odds with each other, and they are at odds with each other. And yet this is exactly the impulses that parasitism needs to succeed. A parasite needs to be able to infiltrate its host, and it needs to be able to pass as its host in order to better manipulate its host, in order to better exploit its host. And yet it needs also to always remember its distinctiveness. At least a portion of the organism must recognize that it is a separate organism, that it's not part of the host. That's where the hostility comes from, or what we interpret as hostility, that enables the exploitation, the tearing down of the other, of the host, and the reaping of its resources and not their own, that they don't take apart themselves, they don't destroy themselves, because they recognize themselves as separate, as distinctive. So both inclusion and distinctiveness are necessary, and it's not really a conundrum. It's not really a contradiction. It's a consequence of their parasitism, of their true nature, and their nature for a long, long time, for millennia, as I've said. The Jews see themselves as a racially related group, whether they use the word race or not. They always have, and they always will. The euphemism they use for that today is peoplehood. When the reality of race was something that everyone acknowledged, as it was 100 years ago, the Jews talked about themselves in those terms. They talked about themselves as a race 2,000 years ago. But as scientists began to really understand and come to grips and uncover the deep biological nature of race, and thus expose the nature of the Jews, the biological nature of the Jews, that they couldn't be defeated by forcing them to convert, for instance, the Jews saw that as a threat, and they came up with a two-pronged plan to meet that challenge, to meet that threat. They deliberately conspired about what they should do in private. These exchanges that Goldstein is disclosing here are from private letters that they exchanged with each other at the time. Both prongs of their defense involve co-opting race science, infiltrating and manipulating it to make their case for inclusion and distinctiveness. In the end, they settled on Boaz's path, and they hijacked and derailed race science. First, by minimizing the significance of race, and that effort was led by Boaz himself, but his disciples eventually came to banish any understanding of race as rooted and immutable to a certain extent in biology.